Hello and welcome everybody to the 2017 first rowing chat of the year. Today I'm joined by Sarah Hendershot Lombardi. Sarah, welcome to Rowing Chat.
Thanks for having me.
Now, please introduce yourself to the listeners.
Sure. So as you said, my name is Sarah Hendershot Lombardi. I live in Boston, Massachusetts, in the US. I have a rowing background. I grew up rowing, went to college and rowed, rowed on the national Olympic team in the US for several years. And now my life contains being on one half, I have a sports marketing role. And then on the other half, I have a coaching position where I'm coaching both rowing and endurance to a virtual membership and to a membership in Boston. So that's really kind of where I am at this point.
Sounds like a very full-time existence. Now, of course, you're a well-known former member, recent member of the US rowing women's team. Obviously, you didn't start as an Olympian. Can you tell us a little bit about your athletic career in all sports? How did you start out?
Sure. In general, something about me from day one was competitive. And so I think my parents just kind of tried to find ways to put me into competitive environments where I could push myself and find an outlet for that. So really pretty early on, I was playing any sport that I could get my hands on. I played soccer. I was a swimmer. I played tennis. And, you know, as I got older and approached high school, sort of narrowed in that focus. And in high school, I was a three-sport athlete. I played soccer, I was a swimmer, and then I found rowing. And really the way that I found rowing was because in the US, a lot of times you're encouraged to play a sport each one of these seasons. And I didn't have a spring season sport, and I was looking for something to do. I was trying to decide whether or not I wanted to do track and field, or did I want to play lacrosse? And somebody told me, "Oh, you're really tall. You should try out rowing, especially since you have an aerobic background through your swimming. You're probably going to be really good." So I walked down to the boathouse and really from day one was pretty hooked, and just continued to do that all through the 4 years of high school. I was just a one season rower, just rowed in the spring and then sometimes during the summer as well. But was eventually recruited to row at the university level, and did that at Princeton University. And so I decided to go there. Then it became a full-time, full-year passion where we were training fall, winter, and spring. And absolutely loved that. And I think that was my turning point, was where I realized about 2 years into my university career, this is something that I want to do. I want to commit myself to. I want to see how far I can take it. And I, being at Princeton, New Jersey for school was unique because the national team for the US is based out of Princeton, New Jersey as well. So the national team and the Olympic team was around us every day, and I'm seeing them in the locker room on a regular basis. And that kind of led me into the transition of trying out for the national team. I got an invitation to stay in Princeton after I graduated, and yeah, I guess the rest is history. I trained with them. Made a few teams, made it to the London Olympics, and here we are.
So do you have a preference for sweep or sculling?
Sweeping, yes. I like to sweep. I grew up sweeping. I learned in an eight. I have definitely grown much more fond of sculling, even in the last 3 years or so, but that was quite a learning curve for me because I did not start out in a small boat. I did not start out sculling. And so yeah, I had to pick that up as I went, but I still would prefer to sweep if I get to choose.
So what I'm hearing in your description there is a gradual building of interest that leads to passion and obviously that led to a very deep commitment. And one of the things that I have heard reported and observed is a very large number of high school rowers quit when they get to university, or they try out at university, do 3 years learning, and then quit when they're just about to get good because the pressure of having to show up for 10, 12 practices a week is too much. Is that something that you've seen in your career?
I have. And to be completely honest, when I was recruited to row in college, I said to myself, I know that this, you know, should be a 4-year commitment, but I'm going to take this a year at a time and I'm going to see how it goes. And I'm not going to put the pressure of those 4 years on myself from day one. And it wasn't really until after my second year that I knew for sure that this was something that I was going to focus on, like I mentioned before. But that really just kind of came from poor results. We had poor results my first 2 years, and I don't like to lose. And I didn't like what that felt like, not doing well and putting in this time and showing up to the boathouse every day and then not winning. So I essentially sat down with my coach and we talked about this leading into my third year of school and said that something drastic has to change if we as a program want to see success. And I loved that opportunity of how much can I push myself in this moment? You know, not for pressure of anybody else, but what can I get out of myself here? And if I don't fully commit, there's no way that I will ever find that out. And really that kind of ended up being a theme through the rest of my rowing career as well. If I don't fully commit here, I'll never know for sure what could be. So you have to go all in that moment in order to reap the full rewards.
And what was it about the program at the end of your second year that gave you the clue that success was possible?
I was looking to these other programs that were beating us and trying to figure out what it is that they were doing differently. And you know, these teams that were showing up and winning the gold at an NCAA championship, one of the big things that they had was just a better foundation of fitness than I had and then our team had. And so I made a goal for myself for the upcoming year as to what number I wanted to hit on a 2K test. And that's what everything for the rest 12 months really was centered around, me hitting that number and then hoping that everything else would fall into place with that fitness. And that plan did really kind of work for me. It's funny because I approached it in a way that I now approach fitness and the way that we think about training and rowing and a lot of the things that we're doing with our coaching now. I approached that summer in a similar way without even realizing it, that I was going to fill a lot of the gaps of where my strength and my fitness was lacking to try to get myself to that 2K ERG goal.
So you were talking to the coach in an individual capacity. Were you also then a cheerleader for the team? Were you a captain for the rest of the crew to bring them along on this journey?
By my senior year, yes, I was a captain. And as an upperclassman, so as a junior and senior, you gain more respect from your teammates because you've been there for 2 years and because now you have a little bit more wisdom. So I did fill into more of a leadership role. And that was very important for our team in our success as well, was getting everybody to band together and to get on the same page. Because when you have a team that's kind of split in your thoughts of what kind of commitment it's going to take to get you where you need to go, it's a lot harder to get there. When you can get everybody on the same page and do it in a way that is fun and that really is more of a bonding experience than anything else, those are the memories that I have the most from my last 2 years of college, of how much the team banded together and relied on one another and pushed each other. And so changing that culture and the chemistry of the team was important as well. And I think that being a captain helped me to be able to lead from that position.
So two other questions. Who was the coach? What an enlightened person. And what were the racing results?
So the coach was Lori Dauphiny. She's still there at Princeton University. I absolutely think of Lori as the most influential person in my rowing career because she sparked that passion and because she cared about me as a human being and not just as an athlete and a rower. And that made a huge difference for my commitment and my love of the sport. And our results ended up being the best by the time I was a senior. I unfortunately never got to win an NCAA championship. I was sandwiched on both ends. So I came to school from 2007 to 2010, and the team won a national championship in 2006 and 2011. So I just missed them. But I do like to think that I helped the team get to that national championship in 2011 because we planted a lot of the foundation to get to that point. But we went undefeated in our regular season, and I was named an All-American for both the 2009 and 2010 seasons. So those were some pretty exciting results.
Which is fabulous. And of course, as a reminder to our listeners, there are some very, very famous athletes who have what you might describe as holes in their achievements. You never got that particular goal, and I guess unless you're going back to school, you probably won't now. But obviously, you move on and you look to other goals and reasons for you to continue to recommit to the sport. So, am I right? You've done 2 Olympic Games.
Just one. Only the London ones, but I did train through the Rio cycle and just missed making that team.
Uh-huh. Now, there are some great interviews with you online, and one of the ones that caught my eye, the headline talked about your Olympic failure being important and more influential than success. Can we dive into what was it that took you to the Olympics, and what was it that at the time you perceived as failure?
So I would call my Olympic success the berth on my Olympic team in 2012. So making it to the Olympic Games, I finished 4th in the women's pair. And overall, even though that came away without an Olympic medal, I would call that a success because I wasn't even really supposed to make the team. I was not a favorite for that roster. And I made it there and I overperformed for what was expected of us. And I was still relatively young. I was 24 years old and one of the younger athletes on the team in that cycle. For the 2016 Olympic cycle, I trained through that entire cycle with the full goal and intention of making another Olympic team and bringing home a medal. And I missed that goal. I did not make the team. Went right up until selection and didn't end up being chosen to make the Rio squad. So yes, that's probably looked at as a failure that I spent 4 years committed to the sport and that goal, and I was unable to reach that goal. But the reason why I feel more fulfillment actually from my second time around, my second Olympic cycle of training, is because of the ownership of the process that I took. In the lead up to London, I was still really learning. I was still trying to figure out what the national team system was like and, you know, what it took to get to that elite level. And so a lot of it was just following the direction of my coaches and doing what those before me had done and just, you know, trying to fill that roadmap. And it got me pretty far. But unfortunately, when I tried to do that same thing for the second cycle, I hit this roadblock of injury. And injury stood in my way for me being able to do it the same way twice. So I was really faced with this crossroads about halfway through that Olympic cycle. It was 2014. Either do I retire because I'm so chronically injured that I can't seem to find a way to stay healthy, or do I change the way that I'm approaching this sport and my training and see if I can do it a different way? And through that path of doing it a different way, I had to break off from the traditional training center that's in the US, and I had to go find my own coach and a training partner that would come with me and a different training plan that would keep me healthy. And through that whole process, I had to decide where that path was going to go. So it wasn't laid out for us. And learning how to make these decisions about what direction I was going to take the path of this journey in and how to solve all of these small problems along the way and keep my own confidence high and believe in our process, that was so incredibly empowering. And I learned a ton about myself as an athlete and a person that I'm now carrying on to life after rowing, where I feel like I can give back to the world better now than I could have without my Rio cycle experience. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that I am, you know, looked at by some in maybe the rowing or the athletic community as that this was a flop, but I truly do feel like I gained so much more from that second time around.
Can we dig into the process? Tell us about firstly finding a training partner and finding a coach and what you said to them and how they responded.
So my initial training partner, I went through a few different training partners in that process, she was struggling with the same sort of things that I was. She was chronically injured as well. And so that first initial connection was pretty organic because both of us were in a similar situation. Either we've got to figure something out or we are going to have to stop rowing. And so we both together broke off and went and found this alternate way of training. And then our paths, you know, kind of shifted and our goals changed, and I ended up getting linked up with several different partners as well. But my ultimate partner that I finished the cycle off with was the same girl that I rode with in the London Olympics. So Sarah Zelenka, now Sarah McElduff. And I pulled her out of retirement and essentially asked her, hey, I've discovered this whole new way of training. I'm more fit and healthy than I've ever been before. I think you would really like it. Why don't you move from your job in Louisville up to Boston with me, and we will give this another go. Because I knew that at our roots, deep down, we both wanted to give it another shot. We loved our London experience so much that we wanted to see what we could do together as a partnership one more time. And so that, it took some convincing, but then once we got back in the boat together, the chemistry was right there again. And that it was a really special year for us to be able to spend together training and traveling the world, essentially trying this thing that had never been tried before. So that was interesting. The coaching side of things as well was really fun and challenging because we looked at this experience as we wanted to collect as much information and knowledge and good coaching from as many sources as we could. Since really the way that the U.S. Rowing Training Center is set up is that there is a, there are head coaches that are set up to run that camp. And if you want to do it on your own outside of it, you have to figure out who's going to coach you. So one of our coaches was my now husband, who traveled around the world with us as well. And he had a coaching background in rowing and obviously knows me very well. And so understood what I needed as an athlete. And that was fantastic to be able to have him on board. We were also able to work with some other great rowing coaches as well. We trained with the New Zealand national team for 2 winters in a row. And so we're able to train with all of their rowers and their coaches. And then we were also able to train here in Boston with Charlie Butt, who is the Harvard rowing coach. And he took us under his wing for about 6 months as well. So really we got a great variety of perspectives that we blended into one kind of formula that worked best for our pair.
So we'll go on to what the training is about a little bit later on, but I first want to introduce a listener question from Sierra Barrow, who's at Halifax Rowing Association. And she asks, did you ever feel like quitting? And how did you overcome that feeling?
The answer is yes. I think most people that, or most rowers that are training at such a high level day in and day out, hit these roadblocks where they wonder why on earth they have chosen to do this. Somebody once told me that if you feel that way consistently for 3 weeks in a row, it's time for you to make an assessment as to whether you're still doing the right thing. Because you're going to feel bad on a day-to-day basis here and there. But if it's consistent, then you need to ask yourself, is this right? So I didn't really ever feel consistently like I needed to stop until I was injured. And the reason why that was so hard is because I was injured for almost a 12-month period nonstop. Or I would come back for a month and think that I was better, and then I would fall back into injury. And so that was a moment where I really thought, I think maybe I need to be done with this. The world or the cosmos are telling me that it's maybe my time to be done. But I, again, had that same theme that I mentioned before kind of come in front of me, where I was thinking, either I need to go all in here and commit everything that I have to getting better and learning what is causing these injuries and why I can't stay healthy and really fix this from a fundamental standpoint, or I'll never know. I will never know if I could have done it. So yes, it was hard, but I again looked to that question, am I going to regret more not knowing, or throwing everything I have in and trying and maybe coming up short?
So for Sierra and for other listeners, let's just run through that exact process, because if they're in a situation where they're feeling like quitting, or if a coach or a coxswain is also feeling like quitting, how do you recommend they approach having that mental conversation with themselves?
So first saying, okay, is this hard all of the time? Do I hate everything about this? Or are there just tough moments that I have to push through? And really kind of recognizing how often those moments that you love are popping up in comparison to the moments that are just not worth getting through. And I think almost everybody will realize that there's a lot of things that they still love about the sport, or about their teammates, or about, being on the water, that do come up consistently. And that it's the hardships and those really tough moments that are maybe not enjoyable that are going to make you a better athlete and a better rower once you can embrace them as part of the process. So first assessing, how much of this is a love and versus hate. And then asking yourself the real question of what if I look back at this, would I regret more? Am I going to regret leaving this team and never knowing, or am I going to regret putting everything that I have into this and you know, maybe learning some lessons along the way, but potentially not getting exactly what I'd love out of the process? That's how I approached it.
Fantastic. And I loved your enunciation of the different elements of the thing that affected you. And it seems that actually the injury was only one tiny thing that in actual fact tipped you into the thought process. Is that correct?
Yeah, probably. I think that's fair to say.
Now, you obviously are no longer a full-time professional athlete, but you're very much committed to being in sport as a career. Tell us about Rowficient, your company.
So Rowficient is still a new baby. It's about 9 months old, but following, you know, the hanging up of my oars over this summer, I really felt strongly about the fact that these lessons that I've learned and that my partners have learned and that all these coaches have helped me to accumulate are transferable to other athletes as well. And that we want to take some of these lessons and pass it on to the next generation of rowers, or really to anybody who's looking to improve themselves. And some of this can be targeted towards a person who's hit a roadblock and is just looking for a way to get over that next hump. Some of this can be targeted for people that want to make sure that they have a long career in rowing. And that's really one of our biggest goals for Rowficient, is that we want to develop athletic longevity through focusing on foundation, resilience, and mobility. And then we want to focus on performance by creating training plans that fill you as an athlete, your specific holes, the areas that you may have weaknesses in that you need to help improve through a strong training plan and through skill development. So those are the biggest, most important things that we're focusing on at Rowficient right now. We're doing in-person and remote coaching so that we're able to reach a large audience that way.
And you've obviously incorporated some of your own unique experiences, and you've come up with this intensity training shortcut towards both fitness and skill gains. Tell me about that as a process. What is intensity training for rowing?
Well, I wouldn't quite call it a shortcut. I think that you have to be careful with that, because it still will take a lot of time and commitment. But it is a different approach to gaining fitness and gaining skill as a rower in the sport of rowing. And really the way that we came about this was by looking at other sports that are similar to rowing that have already adopted programs like this. There are a lot of other endurance sports that have found that high intensity training has a very positive effect on overall fitness and on these athletes' health. And rowing in a lot of ways has been a little bit behind in that aspect. And I think there's room for improvement because we haven't quite caught on in all rowing aspects of that yet. So our perspective is that if you focus on skill, strength, and intensity, you're able to, again, set yourself up for longevity, but it raises your potential ceiling for more fitness, for more speed, and for your ability to just stay healthy and be able to continue in your rowing career.
So let's just back up a little bit. What is high intensity training as a concept?
The concept really is just that you are approaching your training with more hard work rather than just low intensity training. So you're focusing your heart rate zone and your perceived effort zone in a closer to max capacity than to that lower capacity of 70% and under, where a lot of rowing programs are right now.
And specifically applying that, give us some examples as to how you might approach switching a program from what we call, let's call it the traditional rowing training program, to this new one.
So a lot of this depends on where your current athletes are at. And that's something that we've learned through this whole process, that personalizing the program is incredibly important, because every athlete is different and you can't necessarily take a roadmap that may have worked for one team and make it work perfectly for yours. You have to figure out what it is that your athletes need. But in general, the idea is the building a foundation first. And so we've found that using weight training and using the weight room is a great place to develop body awareness and to develop the foundation for having the strength to maintain the rowing stroke properly. When we don't learn how to move our body in space well, we're going to be a lot less able to apply proper force to the rowing handle. So by using something that's different than rowing to help ingrain these good solid positions, we're then able to bring that over to the rowing stroke. And so the way that most of our programs are integrated is that we have three strength sessions per week that are in, that are a part of the training plan, paired with some low intensity skill work of rowing, and then some high intensity work that is combined with both rowing and cross training. So whether that is on the bike or running or it's in the weight room, that high intensity is achieved as a percentage of the weekly work that you're going after.
And so you're pretty much looking at the same number of sessions per week, but a distribution of in the weight room, obviously, and on the water that's somewhat different. And does the intensity also translate into shorter sessions?
It does. So the sessions end up being shorter, but the idea is that you're bringing higher quality to every single one of those sessions. What ends up happening, and don't get me wrong, you can absolutely achieve great fitness with a high volume, low intensity program. It has been proven time and time again. There have been lots of gold medals at the Olympics that have been won under programs that way. But what I think that ends up happening is that more volume opens up the door to have more junk miles. So if you don't have the ability to maintain a really strong position, great skill and great technique, some of your strokes out on the water are going to be not of the best quality. And so the way that we approached my training in particular was that I was only allowed to row for as long as I could hold good form. And then once I wasn't allowed to do that anymore, it was time to come off and gain my fitness in other ways. And you had to earn your rowing volume and slowly gain that volume through great form and great skill. And by doing that, not only do you actually create this urgency for your athletes, but they're more engaged while they're on the water because their time is less on the water and they want to get everything that they possibly can out of that rowing stroke. So while you're getting a lot of great skill work during those kinds of sessions, you still have to fill that area of getting fitness. And the way that you can do that is by adding high intensity because it's been shown through a lot of different studies. And actually, I'd be happy to send you over some that you can post later paired with this. But it's been shown that you can achieve the same, if not greater, fitness through high intensity training, but that high intensity training creates a greater increase in maximal oxygen uptake. And that is why oftentimes there is a bigger jump in fitness quicker from high intensity training.
So the whole concept began with a pretty traditional recovery from injury strategy, which is put the athlete back on the water or back in the weights room or back on the erg for as long as they can manage and build up gradually. Is that correct?
Sort of. Yes, so build up gradually. But one thing that I think is so important about coming back from injury is realizing, why did this injury happen in the first place? And so often it's because our body mechanics or our movement patterns are off. Some area of our body is taking the load that shouldn't or that is not strong enough to take it. And what can we do to fix that from a foundational level before we just simply build back the volume? So really looking at building yourself back up from a base level. And that's what worked so well for me and what we're seeing work really well for other athletes is teaching these motor patterns and teaching them in the weight room. So for me in particular, I was incredible, and we see this all the time, I was incredibly quad dominant. My quads were probably my strongest muscle, and I was developing most of my power for my rowing stroke through my quads. I was leaving my entire posterior chain on the table and wasn't using that to create power. So all of my hamstrings, all of my glutes, all my low back, none of that was being used to create power in the rowing stroke, and therefore other areas had to pick up the slack for that. And one of the big ones for me was my mid-back was picking up the slack for that. So I was getting injuries through my ribs, and then I ended up actually also with a hip injury. So by changing my movement patterns, by looking at actually how I was moving as an athlete and not just as a rower. So how am I walking around? What do I look like when I run? How am I doing a bodyweight squat? All of those things translate into what kind of athlete you are in the boat. And reprogramming those movements, that was a big part of the building me back up into the rowing stroke. So now can I take those principles and can I apply them well to rowing and only letting me go for as long as I could before we move back onto land?
That is fantastic. So were you working with people like Alexander Technique, or was it just physiotherapy and physiology assessment?
I was working with a body movement specialist. So somebody that was approaching a lot of this from the weight room. So how was I moving under load? And then also bringing a lot of chiros in and physical therapists and soft tissue body work specialists that could come and look at this from a very holistic perspective to see how all of my systems were working together. And it's the craziest thing that you will realize once you start to figure out how connected the whole body is. That, you know, if my foot wasn't connected properly to the foot plate as I was rowing, I could feel pain in my low back. So by fixing my foot, I was actually fixing the whole rest of my kinetic chain. And that's really one of the biggest messages that we want to send to our rowers is that your body works together and you have to figure out how to make it work the way that it wants to work and it was built to work rather than just maybe the way that's most comfortable for your current structure.
We're going to take a short break now to hear from our sponsor. Coaches, are you starting to use GPS in your training programs? I did a survey of leading university and high school coaches during December and found that around half of them track and record boat speeds using GPS. With Coxed boats, you can now get GPS data with Coxmate products in two ways. Firstly, the Coxmate GPS. It's a specialist amplifier and data collection tool incorporating all the basics, rate, sound amplification, stroke count, and crucially, also GPS. Additional software you can get gives stroke by stroke data analysis of boat speed curves. This shows both acceleration and deceleration. Did you know you can get boat speed gains by reducing deceleration, not just increasing acceleration? The second way to get GPS data in Cox boats is using a cheaper combined method of two rowing electronics boxes. The Coxmate audio amplifier, which only does voice amplification, and adding in a Coxmate GPS speed meter. This also has software analysis. And Coxmate is fully compatible with NK Nelson Kellerman speaker looms. Buy yours or borrow a demo unit to trial in your club from rowperfect.co.uk. Now, back to rowing chat with Sarah. Sarah, how do you recommend coaches investigate and learn about high intensity training for rowing?
So I would say two things. One being that it is your responsibility as a coach to be constantly educating yourself. Just because you are in a coaching position doesn't mean that we don't all have more that we can learn. So actively seeking out sources that you can to read up about this or go to clinics or pick people's brains that know more than you. I think that's incredibly important. Always realizing that we can learn more and that we can test on ourselves before we test on our athletes. And that's something that we like to do a lot. Okay, does this make sense for our athletes? I'm not going to give a workout that's never been tested before to somebody that, you know, is asking for its training plan because we need to make sure that it's going to get the result that we want and that there is a scientific study that's shown at least that we're on the right track. And so I think just constantly educating yourself is really important. But I think the other great thing is looking for the right people to help fill the holes that you might have in your own knowledge. So finding somebody that really understands strength conditioning or really understands body movement that you can help to bring on into your program to at least either teach you or help to educate your rowers and not necessarily thinking that you know everything. I think that that's been something even important for myself, realizing who can I learn from and who can we bring in that is going to help push me further and push our program further.
That's fantastic advice. And in fact, it's not new. I was personally acquainted with the gentleman who introduced New Zealand rowing to long distance, low intensity training. And he learned it from long distance running. And yes, marathoning. Yep. So So it's completely normal for sports to cross-reference and look to other places where they may find things that will give a performance advantage, but obviously don't expect every single one of them to be instantly successful. I did want to ask you, which were the sports that you mentioned who are already endurance sports that are using these methods?
Swimming and track and field and cycling are all really great examples. And depending obviously on the event, but there has been more and more evidence that shows that when you're training for a mid-distance event, so in rowing's case, it's a 7-minute race for the most part, you know, plus or minus a little bit, and adopting principles based off of those kinds of events. But swimming's been really big, track and field has been big, and cycling.
Good. So there's plenty of sources that people can go to. And Sarah has said she will share some of the sources with us, and we'll put them into the show notes and the blog post right up after Rowing Chat's finished recording. So we've talked a little bit about where coaches can go to inform themselves. Of course, once you've gotten more knowledgeable, you then need to introduce this to your program. And most coaches are running an annual program. How do you recommend they trial it and then introduce it to their program?
Part of the scary part of all of this is that it takes time to see the results. So just because you implement this in the fall season doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to see a huge benefit until really maybe winter or spring. What I would say, and part of the reason why we've created Rowfishin is because we saw that there was a gap. There wasn't really anybody offering this or teaching how to do this and how to implement it into your own program. So not to be a total name dropper, but I would say come to us and we would love to help your program. That's something that we really want to spread to the rowing community, is to explain to you how this should be seasonal, how you can periodize your training so that you're working towards whatever your goals are, and then how you're incorporating high intensity and weight training within each of those seasons. It's important to make sure that you're building properly, because if you go all out full bore high intensity in the fall, you're not going to have anywhere to go. There does still have to be somewhere to build. So it's a process, and not necessarily something that I feel like I could give specifics for right now that would make sense across all programs, but the idea still being that you have to look at what your body of athletes needs help with the most, and if it's power and if it's strength, and that should be the focus that you make the most of while you're out of season still, while you're not in your big championship season. So take the time when you have it to actually fill those holes.
And if you were looking back at yourself in that senior year at university, having the discussion as you did with Lowry, what would you have changed given what you know now?
The biggest thing that I would have changed is working more on my foundation rather than just my scores, because that's really how I approached college. Was I'm going to get myself as fit as possible on the erg. That was my number one priority. I think that if I had given myself the chance to really work on my body's structure and my technical foundation, I would have had to go backwards less later, where I felt like I had to take steps back to slow myself down so that I could build all of that up. It would have been really great to have done that when I was 19 rather than when I was 25 or 26.
And I'm guessing that you can still acquire this knowledge of movement pattern, whatever age you are.
Absolutely. And part of the reason why I'm such a huge fan of the weight room or cross training is because the more strokes you take and the further you are into your rowing career, the more ingrained your habits are. And if you can expose your body awareness to a different movement that you don't have as many reps in, you open up these neurological pathways that then make it much easier to learn. And that's really how I felt. It was almost as if this part of my brain had been asleep, and by adding in new movements and different stimulus, all of a sudden it woke back up and I had the ability to make changes and technical adaptations so much more easily.
Fabulous. Now we have another listener question from Donald Berger from the Rat Island Rowing and Sculling Club. And Donald asks, where can I find good training information for masters rowers?
So this is a tough one. I don't know of any specific places that are just putting out master's information in a really high quality way. I do think that what's important to keep in mind is that as a master's athlete, you absolutely need to be training differently than your younger counterparts. You will have different imbalances in your bodies, different strength needs, different bone density needs that need to be integrated into part of your training. And mobility is a huge one. As we get older, oftentimes we lose our mobility and our flexibility, and incorporating that into your routine is even more important. So that is something, again, that we're really trying to put out with Rowficient. We're trying to give programs that will allow you to stay mobile and healthy, but then understanding the importance of recovering outside of your high quality sessions. Because, and a coach once said this to me, and I still really believe in it, you cannot overtrain, you can only under recover. And your ability to recover gets harder and harder as you age. So that needs to be a more and more important part of your process as a master's athlete.
Now tell me, what's the difference between mobility and flexibility?
Flexibility is your ability to hit an end range in a static position, essentially. Mobility is your ability to hit end range under load and in a movement. So am I able to touch my toes? Great. But that's flexibility. But am I able to create power from a fully flexed hip? That's mobility. So it's really just the functionality of it.
Fantastic. Thank you. Very clear. Yep. Now, I'm going to throw in for you, Donald, master's rowing advice. Go to Row Perfect and sign up for the Faster Masters program. It's coached by Marlene Royal, who pretty much only coaches master's athletes. She will write a bespoke program for you outside of the Faster Masters program. That is a self-coached mobility and technique and approach to training and exercises and drills for racing, advice on racing starts, preparing yourself for racing programs. That's all there. So go to Faster Masters. It's linked off of the homepage of Row Perfect.
There you go. That's another great option.
Now, Sierra Barrow sent us a second question asking, if you had any advice for new rowing coaches, what would it be?
I think this is a really great question. And I think that this is important for a new rowing coach to keep in mind, but it can be just as important for a seasoned rowing coach. And my advice would be the importance of creating the right culture for the different moments in your rowing program. So I like to think about training in general in three different pieces. There's practice, which is skill development. There's training, which is where you're really working on building your engine and your strength development. And then there's competition, which is where you're testing that development. And if the line between those three areas gets too blurred, you won't be able to get in that great skill and engine and strength development, because too much of it can become competitive. And so I think if you can lay the foundation for helping your athletes understand that this right now, this is not a race. This is for you to improve your technique and for you to improve your skill. And I'm not comparing any of you against each other right now. And now this is the moment that I need you guys to test everything that we've been working on and give me your best effort and your fastest possible score. Separating those two, I think, allows your rowers to be in a comfortable, safe space when you are working on that skill and strength development. And that's a really important thing to have in a successful program.
So by using this method, the athletes then feel invested in the process, for example, as you described, of learning a new movement pattern, which may give them the perception that they're going backward.
Yes, and not having the fear of slowing things down. Because if you're not given the space to be slow before you're fast, then where are you ever supposed to take the time to add foundational and skill work? I've seen a lot of programs, and I've been a part of these programs as well, where it just feels like you are constantly chasing and you're constantly behind. And so why on earth would I slow myself down in order to work on these foundational things that will end up paying dividends in the long run? Unless you have a coach that is very accepting and understanding of that and does not penalize for those learning movements. And I think that that's really important.
There's an ebook in the Row Perfect store that is called Rowing Slow, and it explains this exact process. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Now, you yourself obviously have been a professional athlete, but you're now transitioning into being a coach. Tell me about the challenges that you're facing in this new role.
It's very different. So far, I'm really liking what we're doing with coaching, but I would say the best thing that has prepared me for this was my position within the rowing boat for my elite career. And that all changed when I graduated from college to joining the national team. In college, I was mostly only in eights and I sat in the stern of most of the boats. And so we had coxswains that took care of the coaching and the commands and all of that. And when I moved onto the national team scene, we were mostly rowing in blind boats. And I got stuck in the bow seat for almost all of these positions as well. And the way that we had our boat set up was that the bow seat was the voice for a lot of the time, and especially in the pair. And so it became my job to figure out how to coach myself and my partner and to really pay attention to what we were changing and how that responded to boat speed. And so I think I developed an eye for those small movements and those small changes from an athlete's perspective. And now I'm actually able to take some of that and apply it to a coaching role. But I absolutely look at coaching from a very different perspective than somebody, let's say, like my husband, who has more of a coaching background and has really learned what his voice is from the motorboat, really, more than anything else. I still see rowing in the way as if, like, if I'm trying to make my boat go faster and you're my partner, how would I tell you to make a change? And so in some ways that's hard because there are moments where I just want to get in the boat with these athletes and actually touch them and move them and say, no, this is how it needs to be instead. But I think that there's something huge to having that feel and understanding that so much of the time it actually depends more on what the athlete is feeling rather than what you're seeing as a coach. And if you can relate to them what that feeling is supposed to be, you get way more changes and you get way further in the direction that you're trying to go.
Tell us a little bit about those techniques that you use to relate.
So one great example is even just my younger sister. So she is 10 years younger than me. She's the only one of my siblings I was able to convince to try rowing as well. But she's has this amazing steep learning curve right now. It's an exciting time of your career when you're around 20 and you're still relatively new to the sport. And so the way that I love to explain things to her is really from a proprioceptive sort of way. So I will tell her to touch this part of your body and feel what it feels like when it's engaged versus when it's soft. This is how it should feel when you're sitting supported versus when you're sitting lazy. Or figuring out as well what she responds to the best or what any of her athletes respond to the best. Are they a visual learner? Or, you know, does just me explaining it in a certain way really help them to understand? For my sister, she's incredibly visual like I am. So helping her to see other athletes that are doing this correctly and where are they creating the momentum of their stroke from? Where is their body structure? Like, how are they turning their hips over? And then trying to get her to replicate that same thing. I think it just all, it really depends on who the athlete is, but also remembering how did I feel this when I was an athlete and what was the process that I was thinking about and trying to relate it to an athlete through an athlete's perspective.
So what I'm hearing is that you have a deep insight in two areas. One is obviously the feeling or movement that you're trying to achieve in the coach person, but also you're extremely skilled at explaining things and figuring out ways to get your message across to the athlete. Tell me a bit more about that latter. How do you experiment with figuring out the best way to get them to understand?
Trial and error. 100%. And that was what we used to do in the boat too, that I would do with my partners. When I would see one call or a word or a thought process that made my partner either their body position change or the boat speed all of a sudden take off, realizing that that was the one and then adding positive reinforcement for that and sticking with it until it no longer works. Because sometimes you'll get a cue that works great for 2 weeks and then all of a sudden it stops working anymore. So adapting to that and constantly playing trial and error. Okay, this worked last week, but it's not working this week. How can I slightly alter the way that we're thinking about it again? And figuring out what resonates the most with each athlete.
So what I totally agree with what you're saying. And I liked the fact that you used the word cues, because in my view, each crew forms a language of its own. The language is comprised of words. The words are things that we're all familiar with. But if the word catch means something different to me than it does for you, there's no benefit in having it. So anyone who's listening, who is a coach or an athlete, who is in a situation where they want people to respond identically to cues, discuss it. Have the coxswain make the call, and then after the outing, discuss. When the coxswain said this, what did you understand? Stroke, 7, 6. Everybody explain, and then discuss it so that you come to a common understanding. We once had a delightful coxswain called Gemma, who was training us for a big head race in London, which is called the Eights Head of the River. It's kind of like the Head of the Charles. And we were doing a final practice a couple of days before the race. And we were going upriver, and there was a visiting crew from out of town. And as we approached them to overtake, Gemma leant into the microphone and said, "Come on, girls, let's push through this driftwood." Now, we all pushed because we thought she was being insulting to the other crew and that they were as slow as a piece of driftwood. In fact, it turned out there was a boat moored to the bank that was called Driftwood that was alongside us, and she wanted us to go past the Driftwood barge. So we had a call in our race that was Driftwood, and it would have meant nothing to anyone else who hadn't have been there on that day in that crew.
Absolutely. And when you're in the moment of those tough racing conditions, you really can only use one word at a time to mean these big things, especially when you're in a blind boat and you don't have a coxswain, when you're breathing really hard and you have to get messages across. So all of my partners and I had special little code words that would mean different things that wouldn't mean anything to a different partner.
So that's brilliant advice. Thank you very, very much. Now, Becky Robinson from Ithaca University is asking, what's the best advice that you have for rowers aged 16 to 22 about injury prevention, particularly while they're trying to increase volume and intensity in their own training?
So my answer to that would be to not rush your foundation, which has been a theme that, you know, we've talked about throughout this entire hour, but to get in the weight room, 100%. I wish that I had done that from a younger age, and I see more and more benefit from younger athletes doing that early. And I'm not saying that you should, as a 16-year-old with no weight training background, hop into the weight room and immediately start throwing around really heavy, big weights. Absolutely not. Learn how to move in the weight room first. Learn how to move with a light PVC pipe, you know, that weighs 2 pounds, before you even pick up a 35-pound bar, before you put any weight on that bar. And understanding how your body connects to the bar, because the bar is so similar to the rowing handle, I can't even begin to tell you. There's so many translations between the way that you connect your core and your body weight and your structure to the bar as to the way that you do that to a rowing handle. And so I think that that's a great thing for everybody to keep in mind, but to find somebody that can teach you that proper technique and do it in a really proper way, not try to rush you into it, and make sure that your technique is the number one priority before weights.
So learning the technique in the weight room, that's great. But as we've already said, there are 4 other parts to a rowing program. There's cross training, there's erg training and water training. Imagine we have begun and we've got some way down the road with our foundation learning in the weight room. How do you as a coach get your athletes to take that pattern of movement and transition it onto the erg?
That ends up being very seamless, because for an example, this is a perfect movement. The deadlift has so many translations to rowing. You're hinging at the hips, you are engaging your core, and you are bringing the bar with your hips as you stand up. So in the same exact way that you want to hinge from your hips in the rowing stroke, have a really firm core and bring the handle with your hips as you drive. So by consistently over and over repeating this great deadlift pattern, then you have your athletes sit on the rowing machine and you tell them, I want you to feel the exact same thing. I want you to feel your angles be the same. I want you to feel your hips turned over the same way, your core engaged, and now bring that handle like it's the bar. And using language in the weight room that will resonate on the erg, and then doing it the same way, the opposite way. Because at the end of the day, we're not trying to be great weightlifters. We're trying to be great rowers for the most part. So taking rowing language and helping your rowers to understand, this is what you're going to feel when you're in the boat or when you're on the erg, but while they're in the weight room. So teaching the idea of the catch through the first pull off of the ground in a deadlift. I've seen that be hugely successful in understanding the concept of connection.
And do you then use drills and exercises to get athletes to make the identical movement? So you were giving the example of the deadlift on the erg. Would you have them erg with their arms straight so that they don't mess it up? Keep the movement focus on the hinging and the body angles?
Sometimes, yes. So I really like breaking the stroke down into legs only is one of my most favorite, right? So that you're keeping your angle the exact same and you've had that core engagement. But another really great one is to literally just do the deadlift before you get on the erg. And that's been spotted a couple of times at world championships in the boatyard before big championship races. There have been a couple of athletes that have been caught doing deadlifts before they hop in the boat. And so I'm definitely not the first one to have come across this as a really great strategy. But that was one of our warm-ups. We would do fairly light deadlifts, about 30 reps to feel that core engagement, to feel that connection. And then I would hop on the erg to go ahead and do either a long session or an intense session. And that helped me when I was struggling to find that core connection on the rowing machine to actually take it back to the weight room movement, refeel what that was supposed to be like, and then bring it back to the rowing stroke. So even actually just using the movement is a great technique and a great drilling tool.
And your example is very, very accurate, because we know that the coach of the gold medal winning men's eight in Sydney used the Row Perfect rowing machines. He had two of them, and they would drill on it in the boatyard before the Olympics. Each time they went out to race, they had two joined machines, they were linked, and he would have stern pair row, and then stroke would get off and six would get on, and then seven would get off and five would get on, and he worked his way down through the whole crew, and then they got in the boat to try and do the exact same movement pattern in the boat. So I love your description. And I think this is, from my experience, something that a lot of coaches miss, is explaining to the athletes the importance of making your movements the same in both situations. You definitely see people who erg and they finish like this with their hand all pulled up to their chin, like they're tucking their bed sheets in at night. And that's not the way you row in a boat. And a coach that allows an athlete to kind of row for a score on an erg using poor technique probably isn't helping their ability to have a fast boat, in my opinion.
Right. And everything should go back to, what is your ultimate goal? Is your ultimate goal to be fast on the water? Then everything should be with the intention of creating those great movement patterns on the water. I really do think that's an important thing to keep in mind. And just on one more note that you mentioned about that warm up, we're big believers in the fact that you warm up to row. You don't row to warm up. So finding movements that will help you to engage the right muscles and get the feeling that you're going for before you start to put in those strokes, so that the very first stroke you take is a high quality stroke and you're not wasting one on a junk stroke.
Ah, I'm going to write that one down. You warm up to row, not rowing to warm up. Mm-hmm. No junk strokes. I like that. Have you got that as a t-shirt slogan?
Oh, maybe we should do that. Now, quick, copyright it.
Sarah has very kindly donated a prize for the Row Perfect newsletter subscribers draw this month. Every month, people who are subscribed to our newsletter go into a prize draw and a random name is pulled out. I promise you, it really is random. And this month, it is a singlet for if you're a woman and you win, or a t-shirt if you're a man. And it's the Rowficient branded gear. There's photographs of it on our website blog. Sarah, any last things that you'd like to tell our listeners?
I think we covered a lot of it. I really love these topics. Thanks for having me.
It's been an absolute delight. I love introducing new things to listeners around the world. And Sarah has very kindly said that she would like to blog on our website as well. And so I'm very much hoping that we'll be able to bring you more information about high intensity training and Sarah's work as she develops and continues to enhance this methodology over the coming weeks and months. Sarah, thank you for joining us. It's been
Thanks
a
so
pleasure.
Much for having. Thank you.
And until next time, you can listen to Rowing Chat on SoundCloud by searching for Row Perfect. You can find us on our YouTube channel, and you can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. If you are an iTunes subscriber, please leave us a review. It really helps to get the word out about Rowing Chat. And all of these are linked off of the top of our website. There are little icons linking to all of these different social destinations. Thanks for being with us. See you next time. Bye-bye.